keeping the time. The clock wasn't working. Okay, now I'm recording, and so if you go into the web and none of what I just said is there, I guess you'll survive. Okay. And those of you who weren't here today and are relying on this recording, sorry about that. Anything that needs clarifying or any wonderful observations about Bowen? Emotional maturity? Okay, then I'm going to move on to talk about temperament, and you may remember that the first question for this unit was, what is temperament? What is temperament? Too far down? Yeah. Too far down for me to see your hand when you... What do we mean by temperament? Tolerance for what? Tolerance for emotions. Okay. Good start. So some people have less than others. Less tolerance than others? Yeah, okay. Other thoughts? Temperament. Anybody look it up in the book? It's defined there as something like behavioral style. The style with which one goes about conducting one's psychosocial life. That's a paraphrase. It's not an exact quote. But if you look it up in the text, they're talking about it as not what you do, but how you do it. It's a very old notion. There are many attempts to describe the various kinds of people, particularly looking at emotional style, the kind of temper or emotional style that you have. And temperament literally means your emotional style. What has exercised people over the centuries is trying to figure out how to define and differentiate people. What is important as you think about your friends, you think about yourself, you think about the things that annoy you, the things that you like about people? Are there ways to categorize people in some kind of systematic way? Some of the more fun descriptions of temperament apply bodily organs to personality on the assumption that if you're leading with your spleen and somebody decided a couple or three centuries ago that spleen means that you're angry and bitter. So if your spleen is overactive, you have what we call a splenetic personality. You're angry, bitter, resentful. If you lead with your heart, you're considered a romantic person, usually easy to get along with. Idealistic. If you lead with your gut, you may be gluttonous. And you've read all of those. If you have a lot of phlegm, you may be considered to be kind of thick and slow, like the phlegm that you're trying to get out of your throat. And you're called phlegmatic because of that. You have too much phlegm in your personality. Another word for phlegm, if it's higher up than what's going down your throat, we call it snot. Okay. It's thick. It doesn't run well. And it's annoying, as phlegmatic people tend to be. Okay. Psychologists over the centuries, well, over the last century and a half, have tried to figure out how to categorize people according to something that may be a little less artistic. And one of the best efforts that we have has come out of the New York Longitudinal Study, which is described in the text. So I'm going to just briefly summarize what the authors of that study found, and then go on and talk about some of the implications. The New York Longitudinal Study was started back in the 40s, and it was created by a couple of psychiatrists and a pediatrician, Stella Chess and Herb Birch and Thomas. I don't know what his first name was. Anyway, Chess, Thomas, and Birch wrote several books about their study. And what they started with was the notion that if there is a consistent style with which people do things, and if there are differences among people in that style, we ought to be able to identify it very early in life. And Chess, Thomas, and Birch, because of their work with children and parents, were convinced, as they started the study, that there were, in fact, systematic differences among children. And those systematic differences, they felt, came with the children. They were not the result of what parents did. They were important in their work, and Stella Chess led this thinking. She said, they're important because parents are not prepared for the fact that children have their own temperaments when they arrive. And they get thrown. They don't understand. And they blame themselves, they blame the child, they blame the other parent, whatever. They look for reasons for why a child is, well, usually they're looking for reasons for why the child isn't the way they want the child to be. If the child is what they want and is the perfect baby, nobody looks for reasons. They just take credit for that, right? So if you have a baby whose temperament is really just wonderful, you get this sunny kid who never fusses, that's obviously the parent's responsibility. They created that baby. But if you have a fussy baby who's unpredictable and difficult to deal with, that's obviously either the baby's fault or the other parent's fault. Can't be my fault. So they started a study to see if they could rate babies and how they could rate babies. What are the characteristics of babies that make them different, make them unique? How can you distinguish them? So they talked to a number of people and they interviewed parents and they looked at the literature on infant characteristics and what people had said about different kinds of temperaments. And they tried rating babies in the first couple of months on a large number of characteristics. And they discovered over time that they and other people, including parents, could fairly reliably, not perfectly, but fairly reliably distinguish nine characteristics. And these components, they came to call them, of temperament, which are listed in the book, so you don't have to frantically try to write this down. Those components included activity level, and it's pretty clear that babies differ in how much they move. Now, we said earlier in the biological unit, I said briefly that boy babies, even prenatally, move more and move more vigorously than girl babies. So that's one difference which is clearly gender-related. But even within females, there are wide differences in how active babies are. Within any group of male babies, there are differences. There are some who are much more active than others. And that's fairly consistent. Rhythmicity or regularity refers to how predictable you are. Do you always get hungry at the same time? Do you sleep at the same time and predictably in length of time? Do you prep at particular times every day? And this particular one, and that last one particularly, the rhythmicity or regularity of your bowel movements, is important to parents, because one of the things that some parents try to do is to toilet train their kids as early as possible. Once you get a kid toilet trained, then you don't have to put them in diapers anymore, and it's less mess and less expense. If you have one of those kids who's highly regular, you learn that after a few months. You learn that if you give the kid breakfast, wait 30 minutes, put the kid on the pot, the bowels will move. If you've got a kid like that, toilet training's a snap, at least for bowel training. What it means is the parents are being trained by a kid who's really rhythmic and regular. If you have an irregular kid, toilet training waits until the kid can signal you and make sure that you know that he's got to go to the pot now or very quickly. Okay. So how you parent and what kind of challenges you have depend on that and the other factors. If you have a kid who's really active as an infant, you're going to be chasing the kid around more. If you have a kid who's really a slug, you may be frustrated because you want the kid to move around more. Approach or withdrawal. What does the child do? What does the infant do when you present a new stimulus? Does it look at it and go, "Nah, that's, I don't want that, it's unfamiliar"? Or does it say, "Hey, yeah, okay, let's go"? As kids get older, it's interesting to look at those differences. Some of you were the fussy eater who didn't like anything new, or you went through periods of time like that. So parents learn with a kid who's not very enthusiastic about new things to introduce them slowly and not to make too much of a fuss over it, and then eventually, after a few months, the kid will decide to eat peas. It's okay. Other people have kids who look at a food and say, "Okay, hey, can I eat this?" And you have to watch for them, because they're the kids who will take the olive out of your martini, or drink your martini if you're not watching, or put anything else in their mouth and go for it. And those are fun kids to have around, because you can turn them into chefs. You know, they like new things and they like to experiment and they like food. I often talk, you know, about my son, and one of his characteristics is that any new food is, if you just want to give him a thrill, just give him something he's never eaten before. We went out to dinner at the Rusty Scuffer when he was 4, and we were sitting around. He had figured out by then that he liked to eat the stuff on the appetizer menu. And so I read the appetizer menu, and he thought escargot sounded like an interesting word. So he asked what it was, and I said snails, and he said, "That's what I want." And my mother looked at me and she said, "Will he eat that?" And so, "Well, if he orders it, he will. And if he doesn't, I will." And so that was the first time he had escargot, and he loves it, and he loves all those other things that most of us, you know, sushi and other kind. Yeah. Anyway. He's different from other people. Adaptability. How quickly does it take the kid to adapt to a new situation? Do you figure out the new schedule and go with the flow, or do you fight it? Does it take you a long time to change your sleep pattern when you go to school? Does it take you a long time to adapt to daylight savings time? How long does it take you to give up your afternoon nap? What happens if you don't have your nap? Can you adapt to that situation, or are you a lost cause for the rest of the day? The threshold of responsiveness. This is one that you can begin to see very shortly after birth. You have kids who are sleeping soundly, deep sleep. How much does it take to arouse the kid to wakefulness. Some kids, you walk into the room and say, "Hi, baby, let's play." And the kid starts to stir. Auditory nerve is really, really responsive. And it may take only a minute or two for the kid to be fully awake. Maybe screaming, but at least fully awake. Other kids, you walk into the room, you say, "Hi, baby, you want to play?" And nothing. No. So you shake the crib and nothing. And then you pick the kid up and throw him over your shoulder. Nothing. You put his little blanket on and you strap him in the car seat and you throw him in the car. Nothing. Okay. That's a kid with a very high threshold of arousability. And kids differ in how much it takes. Some of you someday will partner with people who can't sleep if anything is going on. Anything. So you end up getting earplugs, white noise machine, you've got to have the lights off. Some people sleep with blindfolds. And put them in a new place where they don't have their usual things and they can't sleep. Some of you will be partnered with people who you can knock out of bed. You can drag them out of bed and they don't wake up. Those are not good people to partner with if you have kids, because the one who's not awake is not going to take care of a kid in the middle of the night. Okay. And I think sometimes they're faking. Intensity. When you do get that kid's attention, what's the intensity of the response? Do you say to the kid, "Would you like some ice cream?" Does the kid say, "Let me think about it. What did you say? Oh, ice cream. Yeah, well, let me think about that." And then you've got the other kid who says, "Ice cream? Yeah, of course I want ice cream. Yeah, what flavor do you have? Can I have a double dip? Can I have a big dish? What can I put on it?" That's intense response. That can also be negative. You've got some kids, you say, "Well, we're not going to open Christmas presents tonight. We're going to do it in the morning instead." And the kid says, "Oh, okay, why?" And waits for an explanation. And then you've got the other kid in the family, same family, who says, you know what he says. And he's very upset, and it takes him a long time to accept the idea that you're going to do something different. And his response is very negative and very intense. Now, all of these are dimensions on which people differ. And part of the question is, how stable are they? Chess, Thomas, and Birch discovered that kids were relatively stable on each of these, that you didn't jump around on that continuum very far. You might move a little bit to the left or the right, but if you were one of the really intense kids, you didn't become unintense over the course of 20 years or 30 years in their study. And they have, their successors have been following, they are now dealing with the adult children of the infants that they originally studied. They're trying to get money to continue the study so they can do a three-generational study. Quality of mood. This is the roommate you want. Always friendly, always happy. Well, some of you don't, because that person annoys you. How can you be so friendly? And other people you can predict are going to have a negative reaction, and they're generally going to be difficult to deal with. Distractibility is related to that threshold of response. And if you're engaged in something, how big a stimulus does it take to distract you from it? And attention span. How long are you likely to stick with something in the face of challenges, particularly? Okay? So Chess, Thomas, and Birch discovered that they and parents and graduate students could rate kids fairly reliably, and that your position on each of these dimensions was relatively stable over time. Didn't mean you didn't change, but it meant that you were relatively stable. Now, how do those... It's obviously difficult to describe people according to their position on 9 different dimensions. And so what do? Get a profile of all 9, and they'll tell you that your temperament is, you're a 7 on dimension 1 and a 4 on dimension 2, and we'll give you a profile. And that's what the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory does with the answers that you give to 550 questions. But it's a little cumbersome for talking about temperament. What they discovered was that some of these dimensions, your position on some of these dimensions, cluster. And this is in the text, so don't try to write it all down. What they found was that about 2/3 of kids could be placed in one of 3 broad categories, depending on where they were on each of the dimensions. And one cluster they called the easy child, because this is the kid who responds well to novelty, quickly develops regular sleep and feeding schedules in infancy, takes to new foods easily, smiles at strangers, not abnormally, adapts to new situations. This is the kid everybody wants. Accepts frustrations with minimal fuss. You can change the schedule, adapts quickly, and generally is positive and not too terribly intense. This is not the giddy, off-the-top kid, over-the-top, off-the-wall kid. This is the kid who's pretty predictable, pretty adaptable. This is the kind of roommate you want. This is the kind of spouse you should look for. One of these. And Chess, Thomas, and Birch adopted from what parents describe the label easy for these kids, because they are easy to parent. They don't really need a lot of parenting. You can change the schedule. You can give them new foods. They don't create a lot of hassle. They are what everybody wants, and they are about 1/3 of kids. That means the other 2/3 are going to get something else. So think twice before you have children. You may not get that kid. That kid, by the way, that everybody expects their baby to be easy, even if they themselves are not. Even if they're married to somebody who's not, they still expect their kids to be easy. And they all want the Gerber baby. That baby that's kind of round in the face and smiling and happy, that's not a newborn. The Gerber baby on the boxes is a 6-month-old. Okay. And it looks relatively mature. And it's an easy kid. The second cluster they described is the one that brought parents to see the child psychiatrist. And they labeled that a difficult kid. Now, this kid doesn't have to be terribly difficult, but this kid with this cluster of characteristics will be a challenge, because this kid responds poorly to novelty and change. You want to change the schedule, or you have to change the schedule, this is the child who will fight. Don't change my schedule. Don't tell me you don't have chocolate ice cream and offer me vanilla. I'm not going to tolerate that. Don't tell me we're going to open our presents on Christmas morning instead of Christmas Eve. Don't tell me I can't sit in the front seat. Just don't do that. Don't change the routine. Accepts new foods slowly. Is suspicious of strangers. Adapts slowly to new situations. Reacts to frustration with very intense emotional reactions, tantrums. Has frequent periods of loud crying and also laughs loudly. This is a kid who's reactive and intense, and displays intense and frequently negative moods. This is the kid who gets up on the wrong side of the bed. Okay. And you don't know why. The third cluster they found, what they call the slow to warm up kid. This kid is not negative, but this kid adapts slowly. So it's the combination of I'll be gradual, I'm not going to be intense, I'm not going to be negative like the difficult kid, but I'm not going to be quite as good as the easy child to deal with. So I'm going to have only mildly intense reactions, and they're going to be balanced between positive and negative. I'm going to have to be exposed several times to new things, and I'm not going to like them at the very beginning. I'm going to withdraw from them. Okay. So you've figured out by now which you are. It also might be useful to figure out what your siblings and roommates are. And really, really importantly, and this is the part that often gets left out, parents also have temperaments. Some of you have really easy parents. Growing up was not too difficult. Some of you have parents who were difficult children, and they're difficult adults, and you've seen that stability, and you figure out over time how to live with your parents. And if they're both difficult, you may discover that they don't get along very well with each other. In fact, two difficult parents are likely either to have a very volatile marriage in which they fight a lot, or they're likely not to last past the 10th anniversary. I just made that up. I don't know which one. I don't know how soon. But they tend to get divorced. Because they fight all the time, and they don't like it. Okay. Take these labels with a grain of salt, and think about the characteristics themselves, and how you might manifest some of these characteristics in a positive way. Let me explain that. Difficult children get a bad rap. They're even labeled bad. Difficult. Who wants a difficult kid? But being a difficult kid, being a kid who likes routine, irregular sleep and feeding schedules, not adapting to new foods easily, adapting slowly to new situations, being that kind of kid may get you pretty far in the world. And if you learn to curb the negativity, if you learn to curb the tantrums, you can convert that style into being intensely reactive. You can become analytic in a pyrotechnic way. You may be very creative. You may have little patience for other people's routines. But you can convert that temperament into an adult style that may be quite fascinating to other people. It is not, in other words, the kiss of death to come into the world with intense and relatively negative, unadaptive style. You may be able to harness that and be able to use it to your advantage in the adult world. Yes, question. I'm sorry, I'm going to have to get closer. The question is, the observation is that if the kid has irregular sleep and feeding schedules, why does the kid have difficulty with changes in routines? Okay. Good question. Okay. And that may be what makes them in part difficult. How would you explain that particular combination? I'm irregular, but I need my routine. I'm irregular. I need a structured world. I need something predictable. And I have difficulty adapting to change. I think what happens as these kids develop is that their own irregularity is part of the negativity and the intense reaction, and their unwillingness to be interrupted. And in order to feel safe and secure, they need the routine. So think about the kid with attention deficit disorder, who is easily distracted, who spends a great deal of time and energy trying to stay focused, and when he or she has to shift focus to another topic or to a different subject in school, has a lot of difficulty with that. If that particular kid has a structure that can be depended on, it helps make them safe in the face of their own input into the situation, which is typically unpredictable. Okay. So I think what happens over time is that those two begin to make sense. If I'm predictable, if I'm regular, if my reactions are not going to be intense, it may be easier for me to deal with a somewhat chaotic or changing environment, because I bring my own stability to the situation. But if I don't have that kind of stability, and the difficult child tends not to have it, if I can't depend on myself, then my security, my safety comes from having a secure and predictable environment. And if I can't have that, if that gets changed, then I get anxious and I get upset. And that leads to the temper tantrums and to the difficulty in adapting to new routines. Take me back to my regular routine so that in my own internal unpredictability and irregularity, I can feel safe again. Now, that brings us, and it's a nice segue, brings us into how do you respond to kids who have these different characteristics. What Chess Thomas and Birch wrote about, and I'll recommend their book, Your Child is a Person, kind of a startling title, Your Child is a Person. Surprise, it's not an android. You brought this person into the world, but what Chess Thomas and Birch try to do in that book is to help people understand that their kids have personalities. Their own, not what you want them to have, not what you hoped they would have. Kids come into the world with their own personalities or temperaments, their own characteristics. And those are not easily changeable because, in Chess Thomas and Birch's view, they're wired in. This is the way this particular body works. It's highly responsive. Its reactions are intense. This is the kid that you have. Don't spend a lot of time trying to change that child. What they would see in their practices was parents who were frustrated because they couldn't make their irregular schedule kid into a kid with a regular schedule. They couldn't deal with the temper tantrums that their highly reactive kid had. So they were constantly badgering the kid or punishing the child for the child's temperament. And that is a problem. So Chess, Thomas, and Birch point out that the child is not going to change. You are not going to change the child. You are the grown-up. Therefore, it's your responsibility to figure out how to parent this particular child in a way that's going to be helpful to the child's development. You're going to have to create a good fit between this kid's personality and yourself, or yourselves, if there are two of you. How do you create a good fit? The text refers to their concept, goodness of fit, which is the title of one of the chapters in their books. They're talking about the fact that you can have a bad fit, and the kids who came to their practices brought by their parents because the parents were at their wits' end, and they were in power struggles with the kids, and the kids were unhappy, and the parents were unhappy. What they were seeing was that the parental expectations and demands and responses to the kid were out of sync with the kid's temperament. They were trying to change the child into something that the child could not be. And the kids were resisting that because parents were making the kids feel that they were failures, that they were bad. And kids don't like to feel that way. But parents were giving them that kind of feedback. So they were seeing the bad fit and advising parents on how to change their parenting behavior to take into account the fact that the child was probably not going to change these fundamental characteristics. You can teach the child better responses. You can teach the child better behavior. But you can't change the child's temperament. Over time, if you parent using what they call a good fit, if your responses take into account who the child is, you may be able to help the child temper his or her temperament. You may be able to help the child learn to be a well-behaved, socially acceptable, nice to be with, difficult person. And those aren't incompatible. You can have the temperament that is highly reactive and generally negative, but you can learn to deal with it if parents and other caregivers help you learn appropriate responses. I'm sorry, I missed the last sentence.
So the parent's personality and temperament don't have anything to do with how the child's temperament is going
to be? Well, no, I wouldn't say that. The observation or the question is, do the parent's temperament or personality have anything to do with what the child's temperament is going to be? Two ways it's connected. The first is biologically, genetically. You don't get your temperament style out of the blue. It's based on the way your body works physiologically, the way your brain is wired, the way your nervous system responds, and that is at least in part genetically determined. Okay? So if you have two easy parents, if they were easy children, go ask your grandparents about your parents and find out what they were like. Do the assessment. You can do the rating. If you have two easy parents, it's highly likely that you're going to be an easy child. And some of those families that we really admire with two or three kids who are all just wonderful kids and easy to be with, we look at them, they're the all British or all American family, everybody gets along, they're wonderful. It's a very small minority of families. You look at them, and it's probably not their fault at all. It's just genes. The parents are adaptable and easy, and they got kids who are adaptable and easy, so they don't have to fight. They don't have temper tantrums because they're all really dull, easy people. They're no fun for a family therapist. If, on the other hand, you have two difficult parents who fight all the time and are highly reactive and negative, it's unfortunately likely that you will be too. The interesting families, and those families are just frustrating to deal with because everybody's at each other's throats all the time and they can't stand each other and they fight all the time. They love each other. They're kind of hard for me to figure out. But then I was an easy person. And then there are those families where one parent is slow to warm up and the other is difficult, or one is slow to warm up and the other is easy, and so you have mixed genes. And those are the really fun families, the families where you have three kids and they could be somebody else's kids. They're not like each other. They differ. You've got a difficult kid and a slow to warm up kid, and they fight all the way through childhood. And you've got parents who disagree on how to parent. And so they're always at odds with each other. So, the first way that parents can have a major influence, is that they pass on the temperament. But it may be a mix of two or three patterns within the family, and different kids may get different genes. The second way is that, think about Chess, Thomas, and Birch's instruction to parents. You have to change your behavior to make it fit with the needs of your child. So if I'm an easy parent, I take that information and I'm not having a power struggle with my kid. I'm changing my routines. I've got a new game called parenting. I can do that differently. Just teach me what works, and I'll be a better parent. What if I'm the parent who responds poorly to novelty and change? What do you mean I have to do it differently? It's the kid's fault. And I'm not going to adjust to this new routine. And if this kid frustrates me, I'm going to have a temper tantrum. Some of you have parents who have temper tantrums when you frustrate them, not majoring in what they want. Your grades aren't good enough. You ding the car, whatever it is. You get a temper tantrum. Those are difficult parents. So parents bring their temperaments to the parenting game. And that makes a difference. What kind of temperament they have makes a difference in whether or not they can create a good fit. So think about the situation in your family. Some of you have wonderful, easy parents and easy siblings. Some of you have families that you can't quite figure out. The fun ones are ones where you have mixtures, and then you see that two people love each other extremely deeply because they understand that they're both really, really difficult. One of my favorite families that I've observed for years has one parent, in this case the father, who's very easy, a little bit slow to warm up, and the mother is extremely difficult and has attention deficit disorder, which is compounding it. And then they got these two kids, one of whom is really easy and a little bit slow to warm up, but really easy and adapts well. And the other one has attention deficit and is a difficult personality. And you know who fights. As one of the kids said one day, you know, if mom isn't around, everybody gets along really well. You suppose, and this was, I think she was 10 or 11 at the time, said, does that mean that mom causes all the fights? And sometimes when the psychologist says, what do you think? But you don't want the kid to conclude that mom is the sand in the wheels. Okay? Even though you know as a psychologist that mom is the sand in the wheels, because mom's reactions are negative. She has temper tantrums. She blows up. She cries loudly and screams loudly and also laughs loudly and all of those other things. They're interesting families when you have the mixes. But those two difficult people will and are, in that particular case, growing up being very close because they understand each other and they know that they're difficult people. And it's been fun to watch the younger difficult child. Catch herself behaving like her mother. And she catches herself and then she will say, oh dear, I just pulled a mom. Let me back up a little bit and try that over. And in her late teens, that's a really important skill. Because she knows she's difficult, she knows she's reactive, but she doesn't want to have the same kinds of problems her mother has. So they're very close, but she's trying to be better than her mother. And she's making a lot of progress, so it's fun to watch them. Because the kids are so smart. They're all smart people. I mean, after all, they got into therapy, so they must be really smart and courageous. But they've had fun with Chess, Thomas, and Birch's work. And they call themselves the poster child family for temperament differences.
Has there been any studies or focus on gender-based? Like, if you're female, are you more apt to have your mother's temperament?
Right. The question is, I think the question is the inheritance sex-linked? Are you more likely to have your mother's temperament than your father's? And I actually don't know the answer to that. I know a number of families anecdotally where people have crossed, where you have a very difficult father and one difficult daughter and a very easy mother and an easy son. So I think temperament genes or the combination of genes may not be strictly sex-linked, but I don't know of any specific data on that. There is some data on one aspect of temperament that I'm going to talk about next that suggests that it is not particularly sex-linked, but it's only one small study of one particular characteristic. Okay, so in the goodness of fit concept, what Chess, Thomas, and Birch are urging is that you modify your parenting so that if you have a child who's quick to react, that you give that child more warning if you're going to change things. You also don't take that quick negative reaction personally. And you just let it pass. I'm a little familiar with Aikido. Right, so when somebody attacks you, any of you do Aikido? Nobody? Okay. Judo? Any of the other martial arts where people attack you and you get figure out what to do with their energy? Oh, man. How did you grow up? Anyway, what happens in Aikido is you take the energy that's coming at you and you don't try to block it. You work with it. And if somebody's attacking you, you take their energy and channel it, direct it. And if you do that appropriately, you can use their own motion, their own energy, and physics to dump them on their nose without breaking a sweat yourself. You just have to be very, very quick and know what you're going to do with them and where they're going to go. And if you're really good, you can throw them on their nose and help them land softly. So it's all about the energy. In dealing with kids' intense or people's intense responses to things, when the kid is about to throw a temper tantrum, it's really helpful to let that energy go by and not try to block it, not try to argue with the kid. That's where the difficult parent has problems. So you have a difficult parent who's told a kid, okay, we got to go now. Get your coat on. And the kid says, fuck off. And the parent says, fuck you. There you are. And now you're at blows. Okay. That's a quote. I'm quoting from a particular parental child interaction that you have seen over and over again. So what do you do with that? If you're the parent who's trying to create good fit, you say, first of all, you don't throw it at the kid, get your coat on right now. You say, okay, the kid's going to have difficulty with this because we're changing the routine, so I need a 5-minute warning. Honey, we're going to have to leave a little earlier than I thought, so start picking up. We need to go in about 5 minutes. I'll give you another warning in 2 more minutes. And then when you get, the kid has a chance to start to think about it. And then when you get there, you say, okay, it's time to get your coat on now. We need to go. The kid still says, fuck off, but he says it less intensely. And you let it pass. Say, I know you don't want to go, love, but you got to put your, I'll help you. What else do you need to do to get ready? So you're distracting the kid from the fact that he's had this negative response. And you're not getting into the battle. Saying, okay, I know you don't want to go, but you know, it's not about you and me, it's about we got to go. And you move the kid along. That's a good fit. You're in the process avoiding the power struggle, you're giving the kid warning, you're teaching yourself to anticipate the response and behave helpfully. And then you're teaching the child the steps to getting ready and getting the coat on and getting out to the car or wherever you need to go. I don't think I need to give you lots of examples like that. They're basic parenting skills. of helping the child understand the situation, helping the child understand the way the world works, and how to deal with it appropriately. Are there other examples of temperament? The best research that we have going right now is by Jerry Kagan, who just retired from the faculty at Harvard. Kagan has been interested in temperament for many years, and particularly whether or not there is a biological component to temperament. And many years ago, he did a lot of research on impulsivity as opposed to reflectivity. If kids who will stop, look, and listen and figure out how to respond, they're reflective. And then you have kids who see something and go for it, and they're the kids who have accidents, who get into trouble, who break things, who don't think before they act. And Kagan spent a lot of time trying to sort that out and see if he could find a biological basis for that. He eventually kind of ran into dead ends on that research, but in the process, he discovered something. And this is a very robust line of research that he's been pursuing now for about 20 years. And what he has been researching is shyness. Because it turns out that if you look at personality problems and people's complaints about themselves and parents' frustration with kids, one of the most difficult to deal with is shyness. Kids who can't enter new situations. Remember the slow to warm up child. So he's looking at one characteristic, one part of that slow to warm up child. And what he discovered is that, and he's been doing longitudinal research, he's been looking at kids from the time they're 3 months old, and he's followed some of the same kids until they are now in their mid-20s. And what he discovered is that if you put them through a series of tests in the laboratory, you can very reliably predict at 4 months, on the basis of a couple of tests, you can predict which of those kids will it says 2 years there, but it's really 21 months, and the text has a brief description of this. Which of those kids are going to be fearful and shy? So what he does, and this is the crucial test for him, the kid is sitting in mother's arms or in an infant chair 4 months, and Kagan or his graduate students put a mobile in front of the kid that's got some unusual things hanging on it, and it makes some noise. It's not scary, it's just there, but it's novel. The kids have never seen it before. And they look at it, and he can put the kid's reactions on a dimension from very non-reactive. These are the kids who look at it. Okay, that's interesting. And they may smile. Okay. And then they look at mom to see if it's okay. There's no threat, so they're fine. And they watch it. They're non-reactive. And they go on about their business. At the other end of the continuum, we have what he calls the highly reactive kids. These kids look at that stimulus, and they are the ones who are really attracted to novel stimuli. They look at it, they get tense, they start to wiggle, they get all, oh boy, look at that. They start to try to reach for it, and then they, after a few minutes, get upset and they start to cry. These are the kids who, if you look at the first few seconds, they're excited by this thing. And then they overstimulate themselves. And they start to cry. That reaction of getting upset in response to a stimulus that you're initially attracted to predicts fearfulness and shyness at 2. And it's a pretty robust prediction. Now, along with that, he's been studying these kids, several hundred kids, for a long period of time. What he's discovered is that those kids who are going to be shy have different reactions in their brains than the kids who are not going to be shy. If you take those non-reactive kids, the kids who just watch, they're not upset by it, okay, that's interesting. Those kids at 2 are going to be confident and sociable. And their reactions in their brains differ at 4 months. What's happening is that the kids who are getting upset are creating a stress response. They're having an emotional reaction in the brain, primarily in the amygdala. They are also secreting more cortisol, stress hormone, as a result of unfamiliar stimuli. Kagan is arguing that this is a biological difference. There are several other differences between the two groups of kids, the ones who are reactive and non-reactive. So he's arguing that there's a physiological basis for this, and that physiological basis is very consistent. In fact, if you have a kid who is reactive, they're usually not extremely reactive, but they're reactive, but they're not giving you the brain responses that the highly reactive kids are, they are likely to not become shy and fearful. So the prediction is from not just the behavior in response to the novel stimulus, but also to the way your brain is responding to that. So he's arguing that shyness and fearfulness are wired in as temperament, and that they're going to influence what happens to us. But it's not inevitable. Some of the kids change. And this is where his research gets really helpful. Okay? And I just mentioned part of it. If you look at the kids at 4 months and then come back and look at them later, sometimes you see change. But the change is an interesting pattern. The kids who were not responsive and who at 2 are confident are not likely to change. They're not going to suddenly become shy and fearful people. So that change doesn't happen unless you traumatize the kid in some way, and that doesn't happen among the kids that he studies. On the other hand, the kids who are reactive at 4 months don't always become shy and inhibited and fearful. And the ones who don't become shy and inhibited had different brain activity early on, so they look then like the confident, non-reactive kids. And they were more likely to have had caregivers who were not their parents. Interesting. So if you have a kid who's highly reactive at 4 months, it might help to put the kid in somebody else's care at least for part of the time. And your sister, your brother, your grandmother, the kid's grandmother, daycare. And probably it has to do with the fact that non-parental caregivers take a more objective, not less loving, but more objective approach to dealing with the child's developing fearfulness. This is a strong argument, I think, or provides basis for a strong argument that having your kid with other people fairly regularly is probably a good thing. For a couple of reasons. The kids who are starting off as reactive and potentially shy and fearful tend to have at least one parent who is also shy and fearful. So the biology is probably closely linked. If you are a shy and are going to be or in the process of becoming a shy and fearful person during infancy and toddlerhood, you may not want to be being raised by somebody else who is shy and fearful. Because that person is going to see him or herself in your behavior. And what you find, indeed, in studies by Park and Belsky and by Arcus, and what Arcus particularly did is fascinating. He went into the homes of the kids that Kagan had identified as reactive and non-reactive. He went into the homes every other month until the kids were 17 months old. And he watched what the mothers did with them. And he looked at how the mothers responded when the kid was fretful or upset. And then what happened to them over time? If you are non-reactive and confident at 4 months, your parents, if they're in this study and are basically normal, can do anything they want, and it's not going to affect how you turn out. That's one interesting finding. But if you are one of those reactive kids who's likely to become fearful, then what your parents do is crucial. If mom responds to your fussiness by coddling and comforting you and reassuring you that you're safe right here, wrapped up in mom's arms, you're going to end up shy and fearful. Does that mean parents should throw the kids to the wolves? No. What it means is that, and the kids who changed to become less shy and fearful over time were the ones who had parents who were reassuring but said, okay, you got to deal with this. Now, okay, that's enough fussing, enough anxiety. Let's figure out how to deal with this. I'm right here, but we're going to face this problem, and I'm going to teach you how to do that. If you did that as a parent for the kid who was potentially shy and inhibited, you ended up helping the kid become more confident by helping the kid figure out how to deal with life. So the transactions that you have with the parents can modify the potential that you could have. That's supportive of Chess, Thomas, and Birch's notion of goodness of fit. If the parenting is helpful, then it doesn't have to, the initial temperament doesn't have to lead to a problematic personality. Okay. See you on Wednesday.
Hi. The syllabus says that we can earn up to 25 points from the class written assignments. Technically, only have
and the writing exercises.
Oh, yeah.
So there's.
Have we only had one though so far?
One. In class writing exercise? I think so.
Okay. Either,
yeah, I think one. Of course. Of course.
Okay. For exam.
Yes.
Thank you.
If that's all right.